This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Greetings to you on this Sunday afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you stay with us as we review the week. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini attended the 8th conference of a coalition of clean water groups. It was the first time they met in Charlottesville, and they reviewed progress in cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, but also potential threats on the horizon to that progress as the Bay cleanup effort faces deep cuts in federal funding. We also have a report on efforts to restore the Great Dismal Swamp more than 2 centuries after our first president, well, literally drained it so he could log it. We'll also hear from WMRA's Scott Lowe, who 2 years ago rode along with Virginia's Safety Service Patrol. They're keeping an eye out for you this Memorial Day weekend if you're traveling the state's highway system. Stay tuned for this week's episode of Our Island Universe, too. But first, 2 reports from WMRA's Jesse Nadler on troubles with the Department of Social Services in Rockbridge County. A long-awaited report looking into serious issues there was released by a court this month. In that report, a special grand jury uncovered that, quote, highly disturbing practices may have played a role in the deaths and abuse of local children. But the report concluded there wasn't enough evidence to establish probable cause to bring criminal charges. And some residents, including at least one DSS board member, are left wondering how.
The board of directors for the embattled Rockbridge Area Department of Social Services held their first public meeting last week since the release of the damning report. In it, the special grand jury found the board's hands-off approach part of the breakdown within the agency. Lexington resident Mark Reed, a 20-year social services veteran, got up and told the board they should all resign.
Personally, offer you resignations.
Child welfare advocate Susan Lawrence, who has battled Rockbridge and state social services agencies for decades, also got up and told the board she agrees. Things got tense from there. Board member David Dax asked what purpose dissolving the current board would serve. Vicki Turner said she found Reed's approach a little threatening. But there was some consensus between the citizens and at least one board member. David Dax expressed incredulity over the notion that the special grand jury was unable to find probable cause, essentially because state laws, as written, are inadequate. This despite sworn testimony that a supervisor created an atmosphere in which children were left in homes where known abuse was occurring, resulting in at least one death. Dax said he found this reasoning galling. Reed agreed.
I felt it was incomplete, frankly raised more questions than it answered.
Still, he took issue with board members' claim they were not even part of the special grand jury's investigation. Why weren't they called in for questioning?
They don't need an invitation to contact the grand jury or the Commonwealth's attorney and say, I think that you could benefit from my insight as a member of the board of directors of the Department of Social Services.
Lawrence also has issues with the special grand jury's report.
They seemed angry and upset and frustrated that the ability to indict these people who were directly responsible for the deaths and sexual abuse of children in Rockbridge County, it couldn't happen. So this looks like a little bit of a cop-out. We want someone to be held accountable.
She is currently organizing a petition to demand the resignation of the board. She presented this information to county supervisors, who have a role in selecting board members, at their meeting Monday night.
They still seem not to fully accept responsibility and comprehend the seriousness of what's going on and what needs to be done. I think it's time for y'all to step up and do your job with this. Everyone keeps waiting for someone else to do something. But please, I'm asking you to do something now. Thank you.
New DSS Director Suzanne Adcock says she's developing a plan based on the grand jury's recommendations for improvements to the agency. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Susan Lawrence has been a vocal critic of Rockbridge DSS, and for good reason. She has her own story to tell about her son and his harrowing experience with the social services agency. Last September, as the special grand jury was being selected, Jesse got her story.
As far as Susan Lawrence is concerned, the latest fracas engulfing the Rockbridge Area Department of Social Services was a long time coming. She's been complaining about the agency for more than a decade. Her main bone of contention, a breakdown in social services isn't like dysfunction in another government bureaucracy. A breakdown in social services can actually destroy lives. A little backstory. For many years, Susan Lawrence, who has a master's in education, ran a private preschool in Lexington. One of the kids at her preschool was a funny, outgoing four-year-old named Michael. Michael, it became known, was being abused by his adopted family. Social services was going to place him in foster care. Susan didn't want Michael to go into foster care. Michael was best friends with her own biological son. He spent a lot of time at her house, so she filled out the paperwork with social services to become his permanent foster family.
He was with people he knew and people who loved him. And then suddenly we got a call saying he was being pulled. And he went into foster care, and just a horror story.
Susan found out through a Freedom of Information Act request years later that Rockbridge Social Services never processed her paperwork.
The paperwork took to be foster parents and the background checks and stuff had never been processed. And so that's why he was pulled from our home. This was a child who, from 8 to 16, was in foster care and horrifically abused repeatedly.
Susan filed numerous complaints that she says were ignored. She eventually went to court and won custody of Michael when he was 16. 2 years later, a court order gave her possession of his foster care file. But DSS never turned over those files until mid-August of this year, after interim director Bill Burleson took over the agency. Each file is 2 to 3 inches thick. There are 8 of them. They show that in his last 2 years of foster care, Michael was transferred to Liberty Point, a private facility owned by Universal Health Services in Stanton that is licensed to only care for teenage boys with intellectual disabilities.
Our son doesn't have an intellectual disability. He's never had an intellectual disability. If he did have one, it wouldn't have gone away. He doesn't have one now. He didn't have one before.
The file points to what she suspected all along, that what happened to Michael during his years in residential facilities is reminiscent of the Jack Nicholson film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Can you imagine being a teenage boy who doesn't have an intellectual disability, locked up in a facility where they're treating you like you have an intellectual disability? You know, your education consists of, here's stop signs. You know, what does this mean? What does the green light mean? That's your education. You're not getting algebra.
Documents from that period show Michael was given between 8 to 11 medications per day. Michael himself says that at times he had to take those medications up to 3 times a day. I spoke to Michael at an unrelated event in Rockbridge County featuring Governor Terry McAuliffe. Michael and his mom used the opportunity to make her case to the governor after the event, so you'll hear some applause in the background.
A lot of the drugs, they'll give a side effect, and then they give another drug for the side effect, and then that drug has a side effect, so they give another drug for the side effect. And then eventually they just keep on giving you drugs until there isn't any more side effects.
He kind of laughs about it now, like it's no big deal. Make no mistake, it was such a big deal, his entire development ceased.
When I went into foster care, I had just begun puberty. I came out at 16 years old and was still didn't finish puberty. So, like, literally all the drugs put me on, like, a biological halt.
His leg was fractured while at Liberty Point. The Virginia Department of Mental Health concluded the accident was the result of inappropriate and unnecessary restraint. A year later, he suffered 2 broken teeth after falling to the ground during an altercation with staff.
Imagine, you know, someone broke your teeth out and then they hold you down in a 5-point restraint and then expect you to remain calm while your mouth fills up with blood and you can't catch your breath because you're at the same time you're trying to fight off 5 grown men.
Liberty Point did not return phone calls for comment. For Susan Lawrence, the failure of Rockbridge DSS to process her foster care paperwork all those years ago goes so far beyond a local problem. In August, she filed a complaint with both the Department of Justice and Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. In it, she accused the Virginia Department of Social Services and local DSS agencies of participating in Medicaid fraud by claiming that children have more severe or different disabilities than they actually do in order to assure their placement in facilities that have beds available. Her complaint is currently being reviewed by the Department of Health and Human Services. Michael is 24 now. He seems to be doing okay, despite his harrowing upbringing. He lives independently. He works full-time. He chuckles a lot. He says he tries not to dwell on bad thoughts, but it's hard.
But then I look back at it, and like 7 years, I don't have any pictures of like me, friends, family, or anything. And, you know, it's one of those many things you kind of like take for granted, and you look back at it as an adult, and you're like, wow, that's 7 years of my life I lost.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Now to a Memorial Day weekend story from a couple of years ago from a voice that is surely familiar to you, whether you're traveling for the holiday or not. Whenever you travel Virginia's interstates, help is available if you break down or run out of gas. And that's not all that Virginia's Safety Service Patrol does, as WMRA's Sunday morning host and membership director, Scott Lowe, found out when he rode along the Harrisonburg route on I-81. And this year, nearly 1 million people, a 12-year high, are expected to be on the road for the weekend holiday.
Most will get where they're going without trouble, but for some...
I don't understand. It just lost power completely.
And it won't turn over now?
Now it won't even turn over. My battery's dead.
That's when the Virginia Department of Transportation's Safety Service Patrol steps in, managed by Serco as part of a six-year, $355 million contract. The SSP helps with the most common problems motorists on Virginia's interstate highways face.
We can give you up to 2 gallons of gas or diesel fuel for free. All our services are for free. We can change your tire provided you have a spare tire, and we can put air in that tire and give you water and do minor maintenance enough to get you off the interstate and back to safety.
It's 6:30 a.m. as I join Dean Webster, a two-year veteran of the job, to see what a typical 12-hour shift is like. First order of business at the Stanton VDOT Operations Center is a thorough safety check of the big Chevy truck loaded with equipment, safety gear, and retractable electronic sign. And then we hit the interstate at exactly 7 a.m. looking for stranded motorists, road hazards, and fresh overnight roadkill, which perhaps fortunately is scooped up by another VDOT contractor. Dean's designated patrol on 81 today is between the Weir's Cave and Newmarket exits, and a driver can rack up between 400 and 700 miles a day, depending on how many and how long service stops are. Just after 9, the first dispatch of the day is a typical one.
I just run out of gas on 81 South.
2 free gallons glug in, and he's on his way. And later that morning, just south of Newmarket...
Are you from Alabama?
Yes.
And any service I give you is for free. We do. This is a free service Virginia offers.
Oh, so
I can help you with a record, and I'll take a look at it. But let me set up some cones and tell her where I'm at, so it's a little safer for us, and I'll be right up and take a look at
it. Okay, thank you so much.
Webster goes the extra mile, even Googling the warning light indicator, but it can't be fixed roadside. So he stays with the travelers, who are grateful for all the help for about an hour until they're towed away. I learned that Dean was a state trooper for 20 years. He says in this job, that experience gives him good situational awareness. And you never know what you might find on the side of the interstate, even evidence in a murder case.
A few months ago, there was a woman that was found dead, and they had been looking for her for a while, and one of the SSP drivers was working the Harrisonburg route and saw a purse underneath the guardrail. Stopped, and it just happened to be her purse, and he immediately called the state police. They knew that she had been there, or whoever had done her harm was there.
As the day progresses, there are other motorists to assist, but we, fortunately, are never called to the scene of any accidents. But that's a big part of the job, too, as VDOT spokesperson Sandy Myers explains.
Safety Service Patrol is of huge help to many citizens, whether they know it or not. They help with incident clearance, and that is a major factor on interstates, particularly roads like Interstate 81. The sooner we can get an incident cleared, the less backup you're going to have.
Near the end of his shift, Webster cuts his hand retrieving a mangled aluminum ladder off of the road. He says there's always danger.
People are so distracted nowadays with cell phones and intoxicated drivers and what have you, and it only takes a second to drift over that fog line on the right side, and that's usually where we're setting.
So if you travel this weekend, watch out for the VDOT Safety Service Patrol, and if you break down, dial #77 and they'll be right there to assist you. And travel safely this holiday weekend. For WMRA News, I'm Scott Lowe.
How can the environmental community unite to make a difference at the grassroots level? Answering that question was the goal of the annual Choose Clean Water Coalition Conference, which convened Wednesday and Thursday in Charlottesville. And as WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini reports, participants regarded past successes as a guide for the future of environmental activism.
The 8th Annual Clean Water Conference met in Charlottesville for the first time. Shante Coleman is the director of the coalition, which is made up of 225 nonprofit organizations. She explains the purpose and content of the conference.
And so this conference is targeted for our coalition members to come and learn about Charlottesville and learn about some of the water quality issues happening here. We go out on field trips and try to see more of the community.
Among the topics of discussion, what the coalition says is real progress in recent years in cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay and how that progress is now threatened. The conference featured presentations from around the Bay's watershed focused on agriculture, communications, collaboration between local communities, climate change, social justice, and inclusion. That included an update on a new federally coordinated strategy to restore and protect the Bay. It was generated by a 2010 executive order signed by President Obama that ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to set pollution limits on nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment pollution in the Bay.
It's the biggest cleanup in the history of the United States, which is really exciting, and it's been working. We have measured success. The bay grasses, the blue crabs, the oysters, the rockfish, they're all coming back.
Rich Batuk is the Associate Director for Science, Analysis, and Implementation at the EPA's Chesapeake Bay Program Office. Together with Beth McGee, Director of Science and Agricultural Policy at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, he presented an optimistic yet realistic midpoint assessment on the program, set to end in 2025. He started with the restoration of underwater grasses.
When we started as a partnership, we were just around 34,000 acres. We have tripled that. We are close to 100,000 acres. We've hit and actually exceeded the goal that we set about 15 years. This isn't a weather event. This is a lot of hard work by farmers and municipalities and homeowners out there.
He was also the bearer of good news for nitrogen reduction.
And over the last 30 years, we shrank it by 66 million pounds delivered into the Chesapeake. That is a lot of reduction of pollution out there as well. That was the easy part. That was 30 years in the making. What do we have in the next 10? We still have got about another 50 million pounds to go. Are we done? Absolutely not. But we're making progress? Definitely.
Let's get the message out. This is working. The science is working. The Bay is responding. It's working at the Bay level, but you know what? It's also working at the local level.
But further progress may become more difficult. In March, the Trump administration released its spending plan for the 2018 budget year, which would reduce the EPA's budget by 31% and completely eliminate the $73 million allotted to the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program. Beth McGee says the fight is not lost.
Congress calls the budget, and so we have groups from across the watershed who are reaching out to their congressional members through this network to say, funding for this program is important, please restore it.
And as James River Association CEO Bill Street says, that advocacy works.
As we've seen, as we've talked to members of Congress throughout the Chesapeake Bay watershed and the representatives that cover those areas, there's strong support for continuing this program.
Coalition members say that if fully implemented, the ongoing cleanup will ensure fishable, swimmable waters, helping to fulfill one promise set in motion by the Clean Water Act 45 years ago. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Now for a mix of history with the environment. Previous presidents weren't exactly environmentally friendly. Roosevelt's Civil Conservation Corps dug ditches to drain pristine New England marshes so farmers could harvest salt marsh hay. Here in Virginia, George Washington drained the swamp, literally, to log the Great Dismal Swamp. Now, slowly, the damage there is being undone with the help of Hurricane Sandy funding. Virginia Public Radio's Pamela D'Angelo reports.
About 3 years ago, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service partnered with the Nature Conservancy in Virginia's Great Dismal Swamp. The 112,000 acres of forested wetlands straddles southeastern Virginia and northeastern North Carolina. Recently, they celebrated the final installations of water control devices.
Give it a shot.
Those are people ceremoniously taking turns dropping aluminum boards into one of a dozen of the dam-like devices. They're placed along the swamp's 150 miles of ditches, most dug by a logging company during the 1950s to move water out.
By putting in these structures, we can not only hold water back, but also route it to different areas of the refuge for storage.
David Byrd manages the $3.1 million project to help the swamp recover from centuries of logging. And there's another problem. The swamp is slowly sinking.
Water's coming up, ground's going down, more frequent storms. It's a bad combination for flooding.
Then there are the wildfires. In 2011, a massive wildfire that even Hurricane Irene couldn't extinguish sent smoke plumes hundreds of miles around the state.
You know, this soil is one of those rare soils that burns, so because it's peat soil. So you not only get a fire above the ground, but it can burn down under the ground, and it's very hard to get out.
Though no nearby homes were damaged by the fires, they have been flooded, says refuge manager Chris Lowy.
This particularly last fall,
We had a trifecta of tropical storms and hurricanes that came in a very short amount of time. During those events, people had 4 foot of water in their homes.
But the water control devices are not a cure-all.
Anything we do is not going to stop, you know, the impacts and the damage caused by such a severe event like that. It was 38 inches of rain in 5 weeks.
Fourth District Representative Donald McEachin has heard about the flooding from his constituents. This was his first visit to the swamp.
You know, this is a part of my district, and it's wonderful to see us take care of such a jewel as the Dismal Swamp. Certainly there are flood issues all throughout the 4th Congressional District because of rising seas and that sort of thing.
Lois says people in Chesapeake and Suffolk will get some relief.
Well, the impact that they'll see is in smaller storms. You know, we get the 6 to 8 or 10-inch rainfall events. We can have an impact to let the wetland be a wetland again instead of all this water running into the ditches and flowing out and downstream into the communities.
Returning the wetlands also will begin to bring back the swamp's native plants and trees, as well as the wildlife like the cockaded woodpecker, reintroduced and reproducing for the first time this year. From the Great Dismal Swamp, I'm Pamela D'Angelo.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe.
In 1983, offshore drilling near Atlantic City, New Jersey, turned up an 8-inch thick layer that contained fused glass beads and shocked quartz grains, unmistakable evidence for a large impact. What we now realize is that 35 million years ago, a large rock about 1 to 3 miles in size hit the Chesapeake Bay area and formed a crater about 50 miles in diameter and about 1 mile deep. This is an area twice the size the state of Rhode Island and nearly as deep as the Grand Canyon. The Chesapeake Bay Impact Crater is the largest known impact crater in the United States. Modeling by scientists with the USGS suggests that within minutes of the impact, millions of tons of water, sediment, and shattered rock were flung into the atmosphere for hundreds of miles along the East Coast. An enormous tsunami engulfed the region and may have even reached the Blue Ridge Mountains. So the next time you're visiting Virginia's Eastern Shore, enjoying a day at the beach, imagine what it must have been like 35 million years ago when a huge piece of rock crashed onto Earth, leaving what we see today.
I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And have a great Memorial Day weekend.